Thank you, Maggie. This impromptu on 98.7 WFMT is supported in part by a grant from the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, a Chicago-based philanthropy dedicated to arts and culture, and by generous gifts from members of the WFMT Fine Arts Circle. And if you were listening to WFMT this morning in the 9 o'clock hour, you would have heard a concert performance from just this past July at the Proms in London of the rarely heard and performed 1879 version of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 with Kirill Gerstein as soloist. And he is going to be here in Chicago tomorrow night and Saturday night to perform that very work at the Grant Park Music Festival. And he's here in our studios this afternoon. Welcome back to WFMT, Kirill. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, such a familiar piece, but the version that you're playing at Grant Park this weekend is a rarely heard 1879 version, as I mentioned. We'll talk about that in a moment. But most of the music that you're playing for us today is from your brand new release, which is coming out officially in September, of the Transcendental Etudes by Franz Liszt. And you have said in the recording that this music is one of the towering mountaintops of the piano literature. And I know Liszt was very deliberate in the terms that he used for his work. So what did he mean by those two words of Transcendental Etudes?
Well, this is a good question because I think that remains subject to interpretation, as obviously does the musical content of the cycle, but Liszt doesn't leave us a very clear answer as to what did he mean by the transcendental, and I think that opens a lot of angles that one can look at this music from. And of course, Transcendental Etudes, we know Liszt, the great or greatest virtuoso that played the piano perhaps in history, and one that is really the father of all modern piano playing, you could say. And the fascinating thing about this creation of the modern piano style, if you'd call it that, is that it took him about, let's say, less than two decades, so somewhere from circa 1830 to circa 1850, where he really comes up with pretty much every technical device that has been in use by all composers that have been writing for the piano ever since, either as a direct borrowing, so to say, or as an elaboration on the seed that's planted in his work. So he really is the father of modern piano virtuosity. And in a sense, so yes, it fits the Transcendental Etudes, a cycle of 12 pieces that go far beyond what is traditionally an etude, a technical exercise, a piece that's designed for furthering the technique of the player. But the transcendental here becomes very interesting because I think it's in its basic meaning of going beyond something. So obviously beyond the scope of virtuosity as was known at the time, but also beyond to more spiritual things. Mm-hmm. And the titles of many of the etudes I think can convey that. You have the number 5, which is the fofolle in French, the willow wisps, so these flickering lights on top of a swamp that were considered to be so ghostly lights. So you have a depiction of that. You have the number 8, which is called Wilde Jagd, so a wild hunt, but again, it's not the realistic, here are the hunters and here's the prey kind
They're
of depictions.
They're being pursued by
yeah,
ghosts,
well,
yeah.
Well, yes, the legend is in English and Celtic folklore referred to as Arthur's chase, and that these are so henchmen, ghosts, and this horde rides through the night, and the way for the traveler not to be harmed by them is to stand in the very middle of the road, and otherwise so terrible things happen to whoever witnesses this procession. And one of the interesting things that it was said that then sometimes a beautiful music was heard, and then this was a good omen amidst the generally a very bad omen, the whole riding of this wild hunt. So you have a number of etudes that really try to deal with the ghostly, with the spiritual, with the impressionistic. The last etude, perhaps my favorite or one of my favorites in the cycle, Chasse-Neige, so a winter storm where everything is buried in this white snowfall. So it's a precursor or romantic version of impressionism, and so the cycle is quite spiritual, quite philosophical, incredibly virtuosic. Returning to your initial question, that yes, it's perhaps some of the most difficult music written for the piano, and especially together as a cycle, it really contains pretty much everything and every neck-breaking difficulty that one could imagine in 100 or so pages of this cycle.
Well, let's hear an example of that. Let's start off with the first piece that you're going to play for us, which is Eroica from the Transcendental Etudes of Liszt.
Yes, and of course, Eroica, Liszt as in some way a successor and inheritor of a part of Beethovenian tradition. So, of course, was aware of Eroica, the symphony by Beethoven, the key of E-flat, and the Emperor Concerto in the key of E-flat. And so this is in some way a virtuosic take on a Viennese march in E-flat.
Thank you.
Pianist Carol Gerstein, who is our guest this afternoon in a live impromptu here on WFMT. And there he played Eroica from the Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt, number 7 in that set of 12 works. Newly recorded, a new release that's coming out very soon with Carol Gerstein of the Complete Transcendental Etudes. And he is also performing tomorrow night and Saturday night at the Grant Park Music Festival in Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. We're going to hear some more from the Transcendental Etudes with you. And wanted to ask you, even though you're playing some excerpts here for us today, do you think Liszt really intended for these works to be played as a cycle, just as you've recorded them?
Well, I think yes and no. I think the conceptual idea of it being a cycle is very much there. I mean, starting from the sort of traditional choosing of the number 12, the 12 keys, 12 major and minor keys. In fact, he was going to, the original plan was to write 24, so he stopped for various reasons at 12. They do go in the sequence of parallel major and minor, so the first one is in C major, second is in A minor, and so forth. So there is this traditional cyclical kind of tonal scheme, which is already shows that he really planned this not as a collection of disjointed pieces, but one of a cycle. Whether this was at all intended to be performed together, I think the 19th century concert practice generally was much less of the style that we have today, where it was common, for example, to play Schumann's Carnival, a great cycle of miniature pieces that I think no pianist today would think of playing some movements from,
right?
That. But at the time, even there is an exchange correspondence between Robert Schumann and his wife Clara, where they are of the opinion that perhaps the Carnival is too challenging for the listeners to be heard all at once. And you know, today this is considered one of the most accessible pieces of Schumann's, and certainly one that you wouldn't take movements out of. So in that sense, I think it's likely that he did not think of it realistically being performed at once. But I think when you see the ordering of which one follows which, you see these traditional tonal schemes, and there is certainly a dramatic arc from the first one to the obliteration by snow that I already mentioned in the last one. So it does have a dramatic and conceptual arc, and therefore I think it's justifiable and quite, in my opinion, interesting as a journey to perform these pieces as a cycle. It seems that the first recorded instance of these being performed at once in a concert is from about 1904 with the great Italian composer and pianist Ferruccio Busoni, who mm-hmm. was a great Listian mm-hmm. player, one that incidentally had quite a connection to Chicago, played here a number of times and was very inspired by some counterpoint teacher here in Chicago. So there's a Chicago connection. But it seems that Busoni was the first one that we know of to play these in recital. And in fact, he did something that I think even today is not dreamed of anymore. He played in the first half the second version of the Etudes, of the Transcendental Etudes, which is even much more overwrought than the final version. And in the second half, he played the final version, the one I recorded. So it gives you an idea of both the resilience of the audience and and his monumental scope and this particular challenge of memory, where it's more or less the same musical material but arranged in somewhat different ways, okay, in terms of the virtuosic layout and the keyboard, and that he could switch his brain around like that in one concert is astounding.
That's amazing. Now, the next piece that you have for us is number 9 in the cycle, Ricordanza, which you have described in the liner notes as Liszt out-Chopinning Chopin. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think you hear that there is a... I think in some way both of them are paying homage to this kind of Bellini-like Italian coloratura ornamentation,
yeah,
translated into, you know, a keyboard style. And Chopin certainly excelled at that with the, especially in the nocturnes and some of the bigger pieces, certainly in the piano, in the two piano concertos, this kind of particular ornamentation style. And I think Liszt, who was a great absorber and synthesizer of musical influences, shows, well, you know, he has that too in his tool set. And the title Ricordanza, is obviously so Italianette in and of itself. And returning to Busoni for a second, in his edition of the Etudes, for each etude he has a short capsule introduction or description, and I've always found the one for number 9, Ricordanza, very moving. Busoni describes it that this piece is similar to a pack of yellowed love letters tied with a pink ribbon.
That's lovely. All right, here is Ricordanza from the Transcendental Etudes by Franz Liszt.
Thank you.
Ricordanza, that's number 9 from the Transcendental Etudes of Franz Liszt, played for us live today by pianist Kirill Gerstein here in the Levin studio at WFMT. Kirill Gerstein has a new album coming out of the complete Transcendental Etudes, and he will also perform tomorrow night and Saturday night at Grant Park in the 1879 version of Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto. And this marks the first time this version of the concerto is being performed in the United States, since Tchaikovsky himself conducted the version on his one and only tour of America in 1891. And you have also recorded this 1897 version of the concerto. And when it came out, that was when I didn't realize, I learned that there were three different versions of this concerto, one of them, of course, much more frequently performed. But you came across this newly researched version, I guess, of the concerto. So when did you first become aware of it, and what convinced you that this was closer to Tchaikovsky's intentions?
Yes, well, to just quickly explain the differences of the three extant versions of Tchaikovsky's first concerto. When he wrote it in 1875, and it was incidentally premiered in the United States, it was premiered in Boston by the great German pianist and conductor, but in this concert, in the function of a piano virtuoso, Hans von Bülow, who was actually one of Franz Liszt's most important students, and for a little while also his son-in-law, before Cosima, Franz Liszt's daughter, left Hans von Bülow and went to Wagner. And Hans von Bülow was a very nice person, because he continued championing Wagner's music even after he stole his wife. So the 1875 version of the concerto was premiered in Boston, and as it typically happens with composers and a new piece, there were a few quite minor, I wouldn't even say changes, but optimizations in the piano part that Tchaikovsky himself introduced. And in 1879 was printed the second, and we can mention second and final version that is by Tchaikovsky himself. And then from 1879 until 8 days before his death, Tchaikovsky conducted this version, the one that I recorded, and the one that we will play this weekend in Grant Park. And even the very last concert that Tchaikovsky gave, the same concert when the Sixth Symphony, the Pathétique, was premiered, the same program was the first piano concerto, and played incidentally by another student of Liszt, Adele aus der Oe, and she's the one that also played it with him in Carnegie. And the conducting score that Tchaikovsky used for that concert with his markings has been actually found or rediscovered in the archives in Russia, and it serves as the basis for the new critical Urtext edition of the first piano concerto that was brought out last year by the Tchaikovsky Museum and Archive in Russia. And so that score, among other things, serves as sort of the last and best known intentions by the author. And then the version that prevailed, and we can discuss why that has been the case, but the version that prevailed was introduced posthumously, was introduced with many changes by an editor, and most evidence points to it being Alexander Ziloty, in fact, another student of Liszt. So you see that we were not joking when we mentioned Liszt is the father of modern piano playing. Alexander Ziloty, it seems, made a number of changes, what in his opinion, and then very much kind of on the superficial side of 19th century virtuoso sensibility, he thought that this would make it so yet more flashy and yet more effective. Now, looking back, I think what he manages to introduce is rather inorganic and makes the piece more superficial without making it truly deeply brilliant and virtuosic. And the fact that this version was not authorized by Tchaikovsky and that it then kept being repeated through printings at Tchaikovsky's publisher and thus spreading through the music world is what led to it being a version that we're most used to hear. But calls to return to what Tchaikovsky actually wrote came even rather early. There's an important Russian composer and teacher, Sergei Taneyev, who was a student of Tchaikovsky and a teacher of Rachmaninoff and Scriabin. And in 1912, there is a letter from Taneyev saying that it's really high time to turn away from the editorial interventions and meddling in the first piano concerto of Tchaikovsky and finally play what the author actually wrote and intended. And Taneyev really knew because he was the first pianist to play it in Russia, even his hand is the copyist's hand in some of the sources for the first piano concerto. So he was there at the inception and he knew Tchaikovsky very closely all the way until Tchaikovsky's death. So there's this interesting backstory to a piece that we all think we know and to a piece that's really not just sort of musically one of the most popular pieces, but I think even in general culture, outside of music culture, it's recognized as a sort of, you know, ever-present landmark.
Well, especially in the opening, and I think that's probably the most striking difference to me when I listen to your recording. And I'm wondering if you could maybe demonstrate that.
One of the differences between the versions hits you, as you mentioned, on the head immediately. And so we're used to the piano entering with these chords. And usually the louder the pianist plays, the more heroic he feels. And the orchestra usually feels, well, for us it actually says mezzo forte by Tchaikovsky, so a rather normal voice, not a shouting one, but the orchestra feels, well, why should we be left behind, especially that we actually have the melody. So they play louder, and the pianist responds by trying to play even louder. So you have these kind of Soviet bombs falling on the head of this poor melody, and there's a Cold War situation, so already from the very beginning. But then we look in Tchaikovsky's own score, and we see the reason why the strings are not marked so loud, and the whole thing turns out to be more lyrical rather than bombastic, because the piano is actually playing. So you see that the second and third chord is arpeggiated, so the notes are not played simultaneously, but one after another. And in this A, Tchaikovsky imitates a certain sort of folk variation on a harp, mm-hmm. harp-like instrument. But what it also does is, through the fact that these are arpeggiated chords, it allows the melody in the orchestra to be shaped more flexibly, and actually the piano helps to instigate it being played more flexibly and more lyrically. So it's a relatively big change, even just in terms of notation, but much more striking is what it does to the character of the opening, making it a lyrical one rather than a pompous one. And then, of course, if the piece opens in this more romantic way, you could say, then it sets the progress of the piece in a different way. Another example that is quite significant as a difference is that normally there are about 45 seconds of extra music cut from the third movement in the version that we're used to hearing. But the middle trio section of the third movement is longer in this version, and I can demonstrate it because it's very much involved with the orchestra and a lot of counterpoint. But what it does is that by lengthening the third movement somewhat, it makes the proportion of the entire movement and the entire concerto more organic, more balanced, and then the beginning, the middle, and the end of the third movement have certain relationship that normally with this performance cut is not coming out. Mm-hmm. So there are several of these significant striking differences, and then there's about 100-150 little wrinkles that are placed differently on the face of this piece. So all of a sudden we see, well, there isn't quite an accent here, and here it's not as loud but a little bit softer, and then there is a different tempo speed indication, and all of these little differences combined with the bigger ones result in the expression of the face. The portrait of the piece is more lyrical, maybe a bit closer to Schumann than to kind of the Olympic sports kind of warhorse treatment of the piece.
And well, it was quite a revelation to me to hear your recording. And do you think other pianists will be taking it on soon?
I think so. And I mean, there are already, I think, a couple. And there is a lot of interest from conductors and orchestras to come back to this refreshed, let's say, cleaned up from the centuries of so dust and pollution version of the piece. So I think we're hoping to start a trend, and at least to make the issue known. If somebody feels like playing the posthumous version that's been changed and edited from what Tchaikovsky wrote, that's fine, as long as we're aware that is what we're hearing. Incidentally, the second version, the one that we're going to play tomorrow, is also has a Chicago connection, because if I'm not mistaken, at the very first concert of the Chicago Symphony, this concerto was played. And when I was in the archives of the symphony, they actually showed me the score of Theodor Thomas that he used prior to 1894, and that score is the second version, the one that is Tchaikovsky's own final version.
Well, it will be played tomorrow night and Saturday night at the Grant Park Music Festival. I'd like to close out with more music this afternoon. We're going to hear another of the Transcendental Etudes by Liszt. And this is number 8, Wilde Jagd, or Wild Hunt, again with our guest today, Kirill Gerstein. Wilde Jagd, the title of that piece, Wild Hunt, taken from the Transcendental Etudes by Franz Liszt, and played for us live in the Levin studio today here at WFMT with Carol Gerstein, who has a new album coming out of the Transcendental Etudes. I guess it's available digitally now, is that correct?
It's available on pre-order.
On pre-order.
And digitally then, and physically.
Right, and then officially in September the release is coming out. And you can hear Carol Gerstein tomorrow night and Saturday night at the Grant Park Music Festival in the 1879 version of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto. And tomorrow night's concert will be broadcast live here on WFMT. Great to see you again, Carol.
Wonderful to be here.
And if you'd like more information about the concert, please visit grantparkmusicfestival.org. And this impromptu on WFMT was supported in part by a grant from the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, a Chicago-based philanthropy dedicated to arts and culture, and by generous gifts from members of the WFMT Fine Arts Circle. Our engineer today was Mary Mazurek, and our producer, Louise Frank, with help today from Michael Sangabino. And I'm Lisa Flynn. Thanks for listening, and now back to Maggie in the control room.